Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. This week, we begin our second special series on California's water crisis. This week, we'll discuss agriculture, which consumes 80% of the state's water. We'll also talk about the multi-billion dollar bottled water industry, which gets most of its water from California, and allocation of the state's groundwater following the historic groundwater legislation. Today, we are kicking off our series by looking at the politics behind water. Who owns the state's water? And who determines how it should be allocated? Last month, for the first time in California's history, Governor Jerry Brown issued an executive order calling for mandatory water rations. Even though agriculture uses 80% of the water, the governor's mandate is mainly focused on urban and residential users. The mandate calls for a 25% cut in consumption by urban water agencies statewide. In response to criticism about agriculture, the governor said farmers have already had their surface supplies curtailed considerably. So, who are the forces influencing those decisions, water allocation, and the price of water? Today, we are joined by Connor Everts, co-facilitator of the Environmental Water Caucus. Their mission is to achieve sustainable water management solutions for all Californians. Connor is also executive director of the Southern California Watershed Alliance and co-chair of the DSAL Response Group. And Connor Everts joins us from Santa Monica. Hi, Connor. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
Good morning. Thank you for joining us.
Sure.
And Adam Scow is California Campaigns Director at Food and Water Watch. That's an organization that works to ensure food and water we consume is safe, accessible, and sustainable. Adam currently serves on the Planning Committee for the annual California Water Policy Conference, sponsored by Public Officials for Water and Environment Reform. And Adam joins me here in studio. Hi, Adam. Nice to see you again.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming in. So we just hit a date, April 15th, and that is the end of California's winter rainy season, which sadly really never arrived. So what are we facing right now? Because there's really no relief in sight. Adam, how do you see what we're facing right now?
Yeah, we're in the midst of a really severe drought, another record dry winter, very little snow in the Sierras. And we're entering a period that could be the new norm, where we're seeing hotter temperatures, less precipitation, and it's going to force us to fix our water management problems in California. As bad as this drought is, our water problem is actually much worse because of our poor management, as much as lack of rain. And we can get into that in a minute. But the basic, most fundamental problem is that California's water house and water budget is way out of balance. Demand is much higher than supply. The State Water Board, which is entrusted by our Constitution to manage water rights, has sadly failed over the years by allocating more and more water rights. Water right is a piece of paper that says how much water you can use. Their job is to allocate those rights on behalf of the people of California. They've been basing their water rights allocations on unrealistically high supply numbers. They picked one of the wettest years in the 20th century as the baseline. This is also true of the Colorado River as well, and Connor can talk about that. And so since that, demand has gotten way out of balance, and this drought is going to need us to force the water board and the governor to get our water house in balance.
When you say demand is outpacing supply, I've heard a lot of people say that government officials tend to focus on the fact that it's just not raining and the snowpack is really low, whereas they don't really spend much time talking about the fact that demand is outpacing supply. And some of these advocates say that's how the issue really should be framed.
Absolutely. We can dwell on the problem, and the problem will continue. We don't see any rain or snow in sight. But at some point, we have to do the harder work of addressing the solution. And the solution largely rests with fixing a lot of our agricultural water allocations. Indeed, about 80% of the water we use is for agriculture. Governor Brown thus far has solely focused on our residential use. And certainly, we all need to do a better job with our residential use, no question about that. But that's not an honest way to tackle California's water crisis. And in particular, we see some particularly severe abuses of agricultural water use in the state that we believe the governor should start And I'll get to that in a minute.
All right. And Connor, I'd want to ask you about that and the governor not really focusing on agriculture. But first off, what are your thoughts on where we are right now? Again, April 15th was the date that California's winter rainy season ended, which we really didn't have.
So I see it a little bit differently, actually, even though Adam and I work together. I wouldn't call this a drought. I would say we're always in this situation and we haven't managed it correctly. So we actually had heavy rains in December. A lot of the Bay Area counties actually got over normal rain. The big reservoir to the north, Shasta, which doesn't depend on snow so much, actually went up, as did Orville, another large reservoir that feeds into another system. So, you know, the problem is we were in the same place 2010, 2011, that winter, right through 2012. Our reservoirs were pretty much full. We had the opportunity to put water back in the ground and try to balance, which is always going to be off by about five times greater allocations or promises or even contracts than we actually have. And because we didn't do any triggers as it got hotter and drier and windier, and this continued, we then put ourselves in the position that it's now called a crisis. However, I would beg to differ. If we had balanced our system and if we had real groundwater legislation with what we passed isn't, we're the only state in the nation. Now Texas has groundwater legislation. We don't. We wouldn't be in the situation we are, but a crisis creates opportunities. And I think at this point, because of the awareness that's come up over it, and, you know, we're on your show, it can work both ways. It can work to our advantage rather than the typical way that the agencies have planned, which is more dams, more conveyance or giant tunnels. You know, they just keep thinking supply, whereas we think, how do we reduce demand so it's equal to other places like Australia that dealt with a 12-year drought?
And how did they do that? I mean, what was at the top of their list?
So they blew up their water rights, and that's the biggest thing we have to do here in California. And they're sacrosanct that, you know, farmers have these arcane pre-1914 rights. We have senior rights and junior rights. But, you know, water flows uphill towards money, and the biggest corporate farmers have been able to avoid the biggest impact. So, you know, I'm about to drive north to go to the State Water Resources Control Board the next couple of days. I will see more new almonds being planted right along the roadside in the driest part of the Central Valley where it doesn't make any sense to grow them. Because we don't have any of those restrictions, even during drought, and the rules we used to have, which would limit permanent crops and limit the size of acreage, have been ignored to the point that now it's all becoming exposed during what is a drought.
So let's talk a little bit about the politics that go on behind the scenes that we might not know much about. Mother Jones' Josh Harkinson had a great piece in September called Hustle and Flow, Here's Who Really Controls California's Water, and that got a lot of attention. And then Mark Hertzgard had a good piece in the Daily Beast, How Growers Gamed California's Drought. That got some good attention. But for the most part, I'm guessing that a lot of people don't understand the politics behind water. So, Adam, Food and Water Watch really focuses on this issue. What concerns you the most about who's really calling the shots here?
Yeah, indeed. One of our cornerstone missions at Food and Water Watch is to advocate for water as a public resource, as a human right, and to oppose efforts to privatize our public resource, or maybe our most important public resource, water. So this drought is a great opportunity to look and see who really is managing and calling the shots in California's water system. For the most part, I think we take water for granted, and only when we have these bad crises do we realize the true value of water. So this is a great opportunity to name some names here. Perhaps the most powerful person in California water is Stuart Resnick, a Beverly Hills billionaire, owner of Paramount Farms. He is the largest grower, shipper, exporter of almonds and pistachios in the world. Most of his orchards are planted on that hot and dry west side, the southwest side of the Central Valley. I'm talking about the I-5 corridor going down into Kern County. They are massively overpumping groundwater right now despite the lack of rain. They are instead overdrafting groundwater at a very alarming rate. One district is pumping 1 million acre feet in just the past 2 years. 1 million acre feet is more groundwater. That's enough to supply all of Los Angeles, San Francisco, San Diego combined in 1 year. Now, Stuart Resnick's Paramount Farms, not only are they massive exporters, most of the nuts they grow are exported overseas, mostly to China. Resnick is also one of the most largest political contributors in California to the Democratic Party, to Senator Feinstein, Governor Brown. Pretty much most politicians in Sacramento are receiving funds from Resnick or one of his PACs.
He also owns Fiji Water and Palm Wonderful, which makes that pomegranate juice.
Absolutely, yeah. He's also a big player in citrus and pomegranates as well.
So since you brought up almonds, almonds has been getting so much attention. According to media reports, it takes about a gallon of water to produce one almond, right?
Correct.
And what I've been wondering is, okay, so the Resnicks are the owners of the Paramount Farming Company, the world's largest pistachio and almond growing and processing operation. Are there many small farmers still growing almonds in California? And what are the differences?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great question.
I would love to talk about that a little bit if I could.
Sure.
So I'm actually going on this trip to Northern California. I'm going to stay at an old-time friend and water colleague near Chico, in a little town called Durham, which is mostly almonds. They represent farmers who actually have fertile soil. They actually have groundwater. It actually rains there, so they're not needing to irrigate imported water all the time. So they use about a third of the water that they do where we're talking about in the southern San Joaquin. Mm. And they represent smaller farmers across the state. You know, on the even in the eastern part, nearer to the mountains, there are smaller almond farms. What we're talking about are the big corporate ag built, growing where they really shouldn't grow anything at all. The soils there are virtually toxic with selenium, and you can see the salts rise up. It looks like snow, and the only way they can actually deal with it is to flood a lot of those areas. So there are places where almonds make more sense, just like cotton makes more sense, but not in that part of the San Joaquin, maybe somewhere else in the country. So we're growing the wrong things, and one of the biggest one on top, I know almonds are on the run, but alfalfa uses even more water, and we grow that down into the Imperial Valley and the desert down there.
Right.
So we've really, just because of commodity prices and cheap labor and almost virtually free water, just the price of pumping, we've been able to really mix up the priorities and what we grow when and where.
And I want to talk about alfalfa in a minute, but on almonds, I think this is really important because in these stories about almonds, there's really no distinction made when you're looking at corporate farmers and then small farmers. And I think that's important,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, no, it's a good distinction, important distinction to make. And most of the attention is going to Resnick and the Westlands Water District. This is the nation's largest irrigation district, also on the I-5, 600,000 acres. As Connor mentioned, the soil is contaminated with salts and selenium, so it actually requires extra water to make the land arable. So it's just a really poor place to farm. It was very controversial to ever put that hot and dry west side into irrigation and to begin with. And long term, we think it makes sense to phase out that land. We just don't have the water to support it when we really get to the hard work of balancing our water rights. But indeed, the almond crop has boomed in the last 5 to 10 years. The production has doubled, and this is definitely coming from the corporate farms, Resnick and Westlands. It is now the second largest water user in after alfalfa. Alfalfa is actually on the decline, and almonds are still planting more and more almond trees in the midst of this drought. Resnick, Paramount Farms, just held a conference about how everybody was making money, celebrating their profits at the expense of our drought. So indeed, as Connor said, water flows uphill towards money.
So as a citizen, if you want to avoid almonds grown by corporate farmers, how can you do that?
That's difficult because, quite frankly, my friends, they sell their crop that actually then is harvested and hulled and then ends up at Blue Diamond, a cooperative in Sacramento. But then those get blended with all the other almonds. So, you know, I would think if some boutique almond farmers could distinguish their almonds from the ones that are grown corporately to the south, they could do really well and probably get a premium. Hmm. But I don't think the awareness of the public had shifted until the last month or so when we've got this tsunami of media response, probably long overdue. But at this point, people's viewpoints are changing very quickly, where a conservative neighbor of mine would yell up, "Oh, we saw you on TV talking about water. Let's just get rid of all the almonds." If we did that tomorrow, it wouldn't necessarily mean we get more water in the urban areas. So we need much greater structural changes, including changing the water rights. And we don't want to switch agricultural crops for growing houses either.
Hmm. Adam.
Really, yeah. Connor's point is important. We need a political structural solution here that needs to come from the governor and the state water board. Sometimes people ask me, oh, I should just stop eating almonds. Don't we need to boycott almonds? And no, people, Californians should enjoy almonds. We can grow them here. We're lucky to have the climate to be able to enjoy almonds. What we need are responsible limits on the production of almonds. We cannot feed the world almonds as we are doing now. 80% of the world's almond supply is grown in California. That's simply not sustainable with our water supply.
And I would also say it impacts the global production of almonds. So ironically, places like Iran, Iraq, and Afghanistan, which traditionally have grown really good and many varieties of almonds, have been impacted economically because what we're doing here. Israel would prefer the good almonds from Iran than to buy them from Resnik, and they've had problems with salmonella, and raw almonds are much harder to find for that reason. So we should see, you know, those that have water and organic and are producing them on the right scale be promoted, and the others, we have to have a serious discussion whether that makes any sense in California anymore.
Connor Everts is co-facilitator of the Environmental Water Caucus. Their mission is to achieve sustainable water management solutions for all Californians. And Adam Scow is California Campaigns Director at Food and Water Watch, an organization that works to ensure the food and water we consume is safe, accessible, and sustainable. And on today's Your Call, we are continuing our second week-long series on California's water crisis. Today, we are looking at the politics behind water, who owns the state's water, who determines how it should be allocated, and who really makes the decisions. Governor Jerry Brown issued an executive order calling for mandatory water rations. So who was involved in that decision-making process? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. What questions do you have about who really determines how water is used and distributed in the state of California? 866-798-8255. And if you work on these issues, we'd love to hear from you. And you can find articles at yourcallradio.org or email us feedback@yourcallradio.org. So, Connor, Adam brought up the Resnik family as one of the main players behind the scenes that we need to know more about. Who's on your list? Or what's on your list?
Well, you know, traditionally it was Boswell, and there's a wonderful book, if people haven't read it, called The King of California, and talking about what was then the largest farmer in the world who drained the southern San Joaquin, where we're talking about now, so that he could grow cotton. And he got the federal government to pay for the dams, and the book tells the story wonderfully. But it also includes oil companies. Oil companies have bought up the rights to almonds and own almond farms so they can continue to put wastewater out and pollute the groundwater, ironically. And they seem to get water when others are cut back. And to be honest, there are some farmers who have suffered cutbacks from their surface water supplies, but all that has caused people to do is then overtap groundwater. So I don't have a hit list. I think it's a much bigger structural problem, but if we started with Resnik, I think that would really bring forth all these issues that we've really avoided to the point now that we can't avoid it any longer, and public awareness. You know, we need democracy in water. We need a revolution in California water. We need to do what Australia did and adopt a conservation ethic. And that's happening on an urban level, you know, where people are pulling out 11 million square feet of turf and being paid up to $375 a square foot in L.A. So why aren't we doing that on the ag when the developed water, which is a distinction we have to make, that they use a majority of, isn't approached in the same way? We need to have metering and monitoring to start with. There's still urban areas that aren't metered, but none of ag is, except for a small community called Ojai, where I was president of the groundwater agency. And I'll tell you, it was like gun control getting it in. We just wanted to monitor our aquifer. We had gone from drought 6 years, 86 to 91, to flood. But they broke the windows, the farmers in this liberal little community, on my house and my car. But a year later, when we went through the whole process, they said, well, these are great tools. Now we know how much water we're using. And I said, duh, well, now we know how much water we have left in the ground. And that needs to happen all over California.
So again, none of ag water is currently monitored.
Correct. And to actually monitor the groundwater, which has dropped 35 to 50 feet in places in the southern San Joaquin. Because it's not monitored, we are doing it by satellites. So satellites can measure the ground dropping, and we've heard Jay Farmageddy from UCI and JPL do a clarion cry that we've got a year's worth of water left. There was pushback from the agencies, but he's saying every year as it gets hotter and drier, and we seem to be in this pattern, he keeps saying we need to do something because groundwater at a certain point, it's like an inverted pyramid. It won't come back up.
Now, groundwater is our savings account for water in California. It's so important to protect it for future droughts. It's really the linchpin for much of agriculture. And what we're seeing is massive overdrafting. That's overpumping when we're pulling it out much faster, at a rate much faster than what nature can replenish. And this is what is leading to ground sinking a foot a year in some places in the San Joaquin Valley. And the monitoring we're getting now from satellites is important to show that rate of overdraft and how dangerous that is. If we continue, as we are in the Central Valley and even in the Salinas Valley, where you're seeing a strawberry boom, a massive overplanting there, you're seeing 300,000 acre feet of water overdrafted per year from that aquifer. This cannot continue. Otherwise, we're going to shoot ourselves in the foot. If we lose our groundwater, we are actually putting our agricultural industry at stake. And this highlights the division between long-term sustainable management of water versus short-term profits. I bet people like Resnick are really after. Resnick is not really, I would say, a true farmer in the sense of the word that comes from a family farmer. I think he's a more opportune business person. And certainly you can make a lot of money in the short term off gaming the water rights system in California, and he has been the master of that.
Adam Scow is with Food and Water Watch, and Connor Everts is with the Environmental Water Caucus. And let's go to a few callers. Let's hear from Dean in Oakland. Hi, Dean. Welcome to the show.
Hello. I have often wondered why we don't have a national aqueduct system. Right now, we have problems on the East Coast with potential for flooding because of massive amounts of snow buildup. And we don't have any water on this side of the country. And it's not to say that we should be taking water from one area and indiscriminately. I mean, I think that the individual states should govern their own usage. But in situations where there's massive amounts of water just going to waste, if we had a national aqueduct system, maybe that would go some length to solve some of the problem of lack of water. Even though it might cost a great deal, it might also give jobs to people long term because the aqueduct system would have to be maintained.
Well, Dean, thank you for calling in. We're going to go to break soon. But Adam, do you want to address that? We got a lot of questions like this during our last water series.
Sure, absolutely. There's always been, I will call them fantastic ideas of bringing water from Alaska or other parts of the country. I don't see them as very realistic and not really necessary when we really do have an abundant water supply despite our lack of rain this year. The opportunity really is for us to fix our system here first.
And Connor, I'll ask you the same question after the break. Today, we are continuing our second week-long series on California's water crisis. We're kicking it off by looking at the politics behind water. Who owns the state's water? Who determines how it should be allocated? We will talk after the break also about the state's 3,300 water agencies. Who decides how water is distributed to urban and big and small farms? And we'll also talk more about groundwater. And if you'd like to join us, give us a call. What questions do you have about the politics of California's water system? This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW San Francisco, a program that relies on engaged listeners. We invite you to join today's conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. If you'd rather write than call, the email inbox is feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11 o'clock from the BBC, World Have Your Say here on KALW. We'll be right back.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll continue our series on California's drought by talking about agriculture. Agriculture uses 80% of California's water, but was largely left out of Governor Brown's first ever limits on water use. So should agriculture be subject to limits, and what are alternative models? That is tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about the politics behind water. And if you have any questions about that, about who owns the water, who determines how it should be allocated, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we're joined by Adam Scow, California Campaigns Director at Food and Water Watch, and Connor Everts, co-facilitator of the Environmental Water Caucus. Before we move on to the next caller, Connor, what are your thoughts on Dean's question? A lot of people during our last series called in and said, why can't we just deliver all of that water, you know, the snow that's dumping on the East Coast, and bring it over to California? What are your thoughts on that?
I totally agree with Adam. That's a fantastical idea. That includes towing icebergs down and running pipelines, as William Shatner suggested, from Washington State, where they're also having a drought. In the first place, I'm not sure that anyone would want to give up their own water. They don't know how climate change is going to impact them in the long term. In the second place, actually running those kinds of pipelines thousands of miles and the energy only exacerbates the real issue here, as we don't lack supply most years. What we lack is proper management of it. So if we bring in something like ocean desalination, which provides very little water at a very high cost, both economic and environmental, that's not solving the problem. We actually need to solve the problem we have before we bring in more water. We lose 8 to 10% on an urban level just through leaks and losses. And there's over a million people without access to clean, safe, and affordable drinking water, and that was before the drought. Those should be the priorities.
Yeah, and we got a lot of calls about desal also. People said, why aren't you talking more about this? Please talk about desal.
Well, you know, I've actually worked on it since 89 when it came to Santa Barbara, and they put one in, and it sat idle for 24 years. And now in the midst of a crisis again, they'll put one in, and if we go back, as we typically get out of a drought, it's with a flood or an El Nino, then it'll sit idle again. They just don't make sense. And you'd need a huge industrial plant every 2 or 3 miles along the Southern California coast to even approach the amount of water we get out of our current systems. What we do need to do is take our wastewater and fully recycle it, like Orange County is doing. But we're dumping 2.7 million acre foot's a third of a million gallons. It should be enough for four families of four for a year. Or in agricultural crops, we can measure how much water they use by acre feet. But the desal plants are just a tiny percentage. So that's another fantastical idea, even though some private corporations named Poseidon have pushed one through in San Diego, is trying to do the same in Orange County. Those decisions will come out Wednesday at the State Water Resource Control Board in terms of the impacts of the intakes and discharge, which are real.
On desalination, there's been about 20 proposed plants along the California coast. Not a single one has been built yet. The one in San Diego is most advanced. And there's been enormous political pressure there. But as Connor mentioned, at the end of the day, it ain't that much new water. So we really consider it the option of last resort after all of the other options have been fully exhausted. And as we're just describing today, we've barely scratched the surface on really reining and fixing our water management problems. The energy use of desalination is enormous. When Marin County was considering building a plant on San Francisco Bay, which would have had enormous environmental impacts, that single plant alone would have doubled the energy use for the Marin Water District, which was already the largest energy user in the county, for something like 5 to 10% of new water supply. So it's really not worth it. It's not going to solve anything, and it's going to create more environmental problems.
Let's go to our next caller. Let's hear from Paul in Redwood City. Hi, Paul. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you. I'm wondering I realize this is a little off topic, but what is the percentage of water that is allocated to the natural gas industry for fracking?
Adam, do you want to take that?
Sure. Well, in California, we have an oil and gas industry here. We frack for oil, but you can also frack for gas. Oftentimes when they're drilling for oil, natural gas will come up along the way. But most of the industry is in Kern County, where about two-thirds of California's oil comes from. It's also 10% of the nation's oil supply. We have four of the biggest oil fields in the country in Kern County. And according to state documents, the oil and gas industry uses about enough water for Los Angeles, I'm sorry, San Diego and San Francisco combined. It's about 250,000 acre feet of water. It's pretty significant. And the way they're using the water is a very big concern. We're talking about mixing water with mixing fresh water with toxic chemicals, blasting it underground at very high pressure. And now what we're seeing is they're taking this toxic wastewater and dumping it into unlined pits or even aquifers that aren't in use but have good enough quality water for drinking or agricultural purposes. And this is the Federal Environmental Protection Agency, unfortunately, allowing our state, which has been very pro-oil and gas, including Governor Brown, to take their toxic wastewater and dump it into these backup fresh aquifers. And while we obviously should stop that right away, the bigger problem, the elephant in the room, is that there's no good solution for this toxic wastewater in California. And this is exactly why we're calling for a ban on fracking in California.
And I just started reading about, like, Chevron recycling millions of gallons of water every day and then selling it to farmers who are using it on 45,000 acres of crops.
Absolutely. This is the Coahuila Water District in Kern County, just north of Bakersfield, where we're seeing almonds, citrus, and grapes. They are using wastewater from an oil field managed by Chevron. About 50% this year, 50% of the water in that irrigation district is coming from the oil field, the wastewater from the oil field. Scott Smith of Water Defense has found many toxins, including acetone, methylene chloride. And the very big question of concern for Californians is, are those chemicals getting into the food supply? We're going to do some more research. We know halos, which are actually owned by Stuart Resnick, are grown in the Coahuila Water District.
Halos?
Halos.
What's that?
Well, halos are the new brand to compete with Cuties. Everybody knows Cuties, those little mandarins. They got bought out by another company, so now Resnick has started his own company called Halos. They're sold pretty much everywhere. We know halos are being grown in the Coahuila Water District. We don't know with 100% certitude if they're taking that water, but we're going to find out.
All right. Well, we will put links to an article about this at yourcallradio.org. Thank you for that call. I want to also ask you about a report out of KPCC Public Radio and the Center for Responsive Politics. They had an analysis last summer that showed the Westlands Water District, the nation's largest agricultural water district in the Central Valley, spent $600,000 on lobbying. And the report mentioned that was by far Westlands' biggest annual expenditure for lobbying, about six times what it spent in 2010. And then McClatchy reported a couple months ago that that water district has hired a new lobbyist. Connor, have you been following this? And can you tell us more about it? Do we have Connor?
Yes, we do.
Okay, good.
So to be clear, you talk about bad players. The one on the top of the list is Westlands, and after that, Kern, and you can't forget the big Metropolitan Water District that's in collusion with those big ag agencies. But Westlands has kind of set a new standard for trying to farm on toxic lands. Quite frankly, about 10 years ago, from the environmental community, we went to them with an offer to buy out their land and keep that water in the Delta, and we wouldn't have been in this situation. They realized they could make more money reselling that water, unfortunately, and they only hold junior water rights. So Westland's efforts at lobbying are successful. I was actually in D.C. recently talking to the World Bank on world security and water issues, which means the human right to water everywhere else. Here it means how do the agencies get more water. Westlands is about to get a settlement from the Bureau of Reclamation. What they're good at is suing people. They also take water out of the Trinity. And they have we have not been able to see that settlement, but what it will mean is that they can perfect their junior rights, that they're going to get more water during the drought and not have to pay for it, and not have to do the cleanup of the selenium, what was called Kesterson, which was a ponding of this water that killed 250,000 birds, and that's never really been settled. So because they use the threat of lawsuits successfully and follow through, they seem to have a lot of power. But in reality, they shouldn't have that power, nor should they have that water, and they should rethink what they grow. Yet few groups are willing to stand up to them, and one of them is Food and Water Watch, and Adam can tell you more about that.
Sure. Thank you, Connor. Well, Westlands Water District is enormously powerful, and one thing that might be a little bit surprising is sometimes we think of the senior water rights holders as the big power brokers, but Westlands and much of Resnick are actually junior water rights holders. They came to the game later. I mean, this almond boom is recent, but their political power, the contributions they bring, their connections to Senator Feinstein, Governor Brown, are very strong, and they've been able to game the system to get way more water than they should be getting in that hot and dry desert climate. Their water is either coming from groundwater, which they're massively overpumping, or they're diverting water away from the San Francisco Bay Delta. And the biggest, latest scheme that Westlands and Resnick are supporting is Governor Brown's plan to build two massive tunnels to divert the Sacramento River north of the San Francisco Bay Delta. This is a $70 billion project. The governor reaffirmed his support for it last week at a press conference, that we build these massive tunnels 40 miles long, 40 feet wide each, to take the Sacramento River away from San Francisco Bay directly to the massive pumps near Tracy, where the water is then pumped down to the west side. This is a project we've long opposed. Governor Brown tried to do this in the early 80s. It was called the Peripheral Canal, and it was defeated in a historic vote by the people of California. Brown is back. Westlands and Resnick are pushing for it again, and this is something that needs to be stopped.
And again, the Westlands Water District, it's the nation's largest agricultural water district in the Central Valley. And how are they allowed to do this when you say take the water? How are they allowed to do that?
Well, historically, we built these projects, and we, I mean federal and state taxpayers, this is really our water, so we have every right to demand some changes in accountability. This is not some natural market conclusion. These were specific political decisions made over time, and they were very controversial. And so in some cases, we need to right the previous wrong. But these systems, these pumps, were built to help supplement the water in the Central Valley to ensure family farmers could farm and stay in business. It's been grossly abused, and now we're seeing more and more water taken the last 20 years. Way too much water has been taken away from the Bay Delta to support these new empires of almonds and pistachios in particular. And that is completely devastating to our salmon population, the fishing populations, the fishermen who have had a local economy here in the Bay Area and up the North Coast, where we're seeing salmon populations near extinction this year. So it's really coming at their expense, and it's way out of balance. So long term, we have to right the wrong. That means we need to limit almond and pistachio production on the west side, and in the long term, phase it out and retire that land.
Adam Scow is California Campaigns Director at Food and Water Watch. Connor Everts is co-facilitator of the Environmental Water Caucus. Today, we are starting our second week-long series on California's water crisis and the drought. Today, we're talking about the politics behind water, who owns the state's water, who determines how it should be allocated. What questions do you have about the politics and the big players in water politics in California? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's go next to Pamela in Oakland. Hi, Pamela. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. I have a personal experience with this. I grew up on my grandmother's ranch between Madera and Fresno, right in the heart of the Central Valley. First turned to oats and barley and wheat during the Second World War by my grandfather, and then after he died, it was cattle. And at one time I went there and visited in the 80s, and this cowboy took me over to the pump house, which was normally water brought up from the aquifer by a windmill only. And, in fact, I grew up without electricity or, you know, phones or anything out there. And and he said, look, watch the water bounce up and down rhythmically. And I said, what in God's name is that? And he said, well, 25 miles west of here in Madera, there are sugar beet crops, which are junk crops, basically. They can be grown practically in a desert, you know, instead of using a good, rich soil around there. And they get subsidies from the county, the state, and the feds to grow these junk crops, that and, like, cotton in the southern San Joaquin. And I watched during the 60s and 70s these beautiful family farms, abundant, rich, you know, being the breadbasket and food basket of America, be turned over to oil companies masquerading as agribiz. You know, a lot of agribiz in the Central Valley is owned by oil companies. And I said, who allows them to do that? You know, I mean, basically, every time the sprinklers went ka-chunk, ka-chunk 25 miles away, my grandmother's water went plunk, plunk, plunk down in the aquifer and in the pump house. And I said, this is affecting everybody for, you know, dozens of miles around. How can this be? And he said, well, contact your legislator. Mm-hmm. They gave them all these subsidies. So what I want to know is who's given away these subsidies, to whom, and how much, and who's keeping statistics on it?
Well, thank you, Pamela. Thank you for sharing that story. Connor, do you want to take that one first?
Sure. And you know, that's a good local perspective, historically, what has happened. And I appreciate that. And you know, I admire the small farmers who are out there trying to compete. Mm-hmm. They are the lifeblood of what have been historically farms that were supposed to be 160 acres or less. Now we're talking about farms that are 16,000 acres and more often. It's just amazing, the scale. So the best place is Environmental Working Group has a website where they actually list all the farms and they list the subsidies they get. And I think that's the one place that has been tracking them pretty regularly. I know Food and Water Watch and Adam worked on the farm bill to try to get some reform on that. But we're essentially, because of subsidies, we're exporting our water, and we're exporting it very cheaply in these crops. So when 80% of the almonds go overseas, there goes our water and our groundwater and our future. So we have to really have it's a revolution in water and a revolution on agriculture and how we grow things. And then that extends to grapes. You know, everyone loves wine, but what's happening around the Paso Robles area with new vineyards coming in, and my friend who had a horse ranch well went dry. They tried to set up a groundwater agency where it's 1 acre, one vote. You know, it's not unusual in irrigation districts where you have to be a landowner to vote. Even in some of the urban environmental justice areas, it's the same. In these leftover arcane little water agencies that came out of agricultural agencies. So we have to change that and get real representations of these communities who don't even have access to clean drinking water because the groundwater is polluted. And then that polluted groundwater, as you mentioned, is being used on crops as well.
Adam?
Yeah, and the subsidy question here in California, most of the subsidy comes via water. And I think for the most part, we recognize that farm water does need to be subsidized to some extent. They can't pay the same rate as urban users or other users. Otherwise, that makes farming very expensive. So just cutting subsidies or adjusting subsidies isn't really getting to the heart of the power dynamics of the problem. You know, almonds are not subsidized from any federal subsidy, but certainly the water they're getting is very cheap. On the west side, we're talking $30 to $70 per acre feet of water. It's literally pennies, less than pennies on the gallon. And some would say the water rates we pay in urban areas is pretty cheap still. We probably pay about $500 to $700 per acre feet of water here in the Bay Area. But I want to say the Central Valley in the history the caller gave about consolidation and big corporate agribusiness and oil companies buying out farms, that is really a sad history that has taken place in the Central Valley, where initially the intention was for family farms to help settle the land. We've seen the system abused. We've seen the cheap water abused. And we've seen some of the biggest corporate farms emerge. And the food needs of the Central Valley are not being met. This is the big irony and probably the best example of what's wrong with our food system in the Central Valley. Not only are we seeing water abuse, pesticides, some of the worst air pollution in the country is in the Central Valley, but on top of that, we have some of the highest poverty and highest hunger rates in the nation.
Right.
You look at Fresno County, Kern County, here the highest hunger rates in the midst of the most productive agricultural region in the world. So when we hear Big Ag talk about jobs in the economy of the almond industry, we take a step back and laugh and shake our head. And how sad that really is. When we see record high unemployment in these places, it has not changed because we're planting more almonds, many of which are mostly mechanized. And all the profits that are coming from that industry are going to the top. People like Resnick.
NPR had a good piece about a rural community in Fairmead, California, about an hour north of Fresno. And it's a mostly African-American community, and they have no water. They've run out
As
of water.
Connor said, there's about a million people in California without access to clean drinking water. Some of them have been there for a long time. And in some places, the situation has gotten worse. You can look at Porterville, a small town on the eastern side.
Right.
The wells have gone dry. And some of this has to do with groundwater being overpumped. It's very expensive to drill deeper and deeper. Big farms can afford it, but small rural communities, $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 to drill deeper is not affordable.
Yeah, we're going to have to do another show about that. Going back to the power brokers, we've talked about a number of them. Who are some of the other influential players that carry a lot of weight in Sacramento that we should know about?
Well, and I would say in addition to Westlands, Resnick, and Resnick is a Kern County Water Agency because that's also where the oil companies are getting their water, Westlands, Kern. We talk about the Big Three and the Metropolitan Water District of Southern California. Now, Metropolitan Water District of Southern California is the big wholesale supplier. They import water from Colorado River and from the Bay Delta and sell it to all the cities throughout Southern California. Now, a lot of the cities in Southern California are actually doing a pretty good job of reducing their water use. In some cases, they're ahead of us in Northern California. They've had to be more efficient. People like Connor have led the charge in conservation in Pasadena and Los Angeles. So you look at Los Angeles, they're using less water today than they did 20 years ago, 30 years ago, despite population growth of a million people. And there's still a long ways to go. On the other hand, Metropolitan, which sells them the water, is very much interested in more water for their own political and power goals. They have recently formed partnerships with Westlands and Kern to game and get more state water for themselves at everybody else's expense, whether that's taxpayers or the ratepayers in Southern California who, for instance, would be forced to pay for these massive tunnels we're talking about from the Sacramento River, mostly to the benefit of Westlands, Kern, and Metropolitan. The other force we've seen is real estate development. Maybe that's been on hold a little bit with the economy. We've always seen new real estate developers needing more water to get their real estate developments approved. In California, we have a law called Show Me the Water. If you want to build a new housing development, you have to show you have a water supply. Well, interests like Metropolitan and even Westlands and Kern now are all in a position and are trying to position themselves to be able to sell their water, their subsidized water, for private profit to real estate developers. We saw one deal where a Central Valley farm cut a deal for $77 million to the Mojave Water Agency to get a new real estate development there approved. So this is the ultimate abuse of California's water. Resnick is also has positioned himself to do this. He has taken over a underground publicly owned aquifer called the Kern County Water Bank. It was illegally transferred. It's now in litigation. Resnick is very much in position. Beyond almonds and pistachios, the most valuable crop there is the water itself.
Well, thank you for that, Adam. And what about you, Connor? We've got just a couple minutes left. What would you add to that? And do you want to give us any information about water agencies?
Sure. So I would recommend a great piece written by John Gibler called Water Heist that describes a lot of this. Came out through Public Citizen, kind of a predecessor for the Food and Water Watch program. Excellent research, well done, and tells this story, and it really hasn't changed since 2003. So the big players are the big agencies. The Metropolitan Water District has 37 board members now. They're all appointed, not elected. They're not accountable, really, to anybody. We have a much stronger LA delegation than we ever had. People in San Diego just hate the Metropolitan Water District so much they spent $1 billion for a desal plant they don't really need, puts them in the same places. Australia, where they built six and four of them, sit idle now, and you're going to have to pay for them whether you need the water or not. I would say San Diego, Los Angeles, but I also like to give credit for some good agencies. The Long Beach Water Department is the most progressive and has really continued to drop its usage. And tomorrow we're having a discussion on where these urban percentages fall. And it's going to be a range, I think, of 6 to 38%. It'll be finalized. So those who have continued to waste the most will get hit the hardest. Places like Beverly Hills that has never run a conservation program, whereas Long Beach
never,
ever. So Long Beach.
Just quickly, why?
Because they didn't have to.
Huh.
We didn't have mandatory during the long drought when I was actually working for agencies doing conservation. We did 27% in Pasadena. My friend was running Santa Monica's, and they said, Beverly Hills called up and said, will you run our conservation program? And she said, well, you're going to pay for it? And they said, no, we just don't want to do it. So we're now at the point where we're going to go back to these agencies. But the missing link here is, you know, I've mentioned this before, if ag were to save more water, and there are a lot of places that have done that effectively because their demand has dropped as their allocations have dropped. There are urban areas where they're doing ag, where they're actually taking that water at $600 to $1,000 and really being efficient with it as well. You know, and growing high-value crops like avocados and maybe using reclaimed water. So we do have some good examples out there, but the most egregious are those agencies on an urban level that are using as much as 400 or 500 gallons per day per person, and on an ag level that continue to aggressively go out and get new supply and focus the water bond that both Adam and I were against to build new dams, which would be slabs of concrete in the sky. 2.7 of the $7.5 billion was allocated for that. Only $250 million was for water conservation, both ag and urban. So we are now put ourselves in a situation where we have some political solutions that aren't, and we have some major change that needs to come. So everyone knows Mark Twain's quote, but the one I like is that he says he likes progress. It's change he has a hard time with, and change has to come to California water.
And Connor, I just want to end on a note in terms of change. What is at the top of your list? I mean, I want to do an entire show on this, but what would you change if you could tomorrow? Just 10 seconds.
Sure. I would change the groundwater laws, and I would actually have metering and monitoring and reevaluate the water rights. And I have to throw in golf courses. We have 866 in the state, and only 216 use some level of recycle. That's just absurd.
Connor Everts is co-facilitator of the Environmental Water Caucus. Adam Scow is California Campaigns Director at Food and Water Watch. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. How is the drought affecting California's agriculture? On the next Your Call, we'll continue our week-long series on the water crisis by discussing agriculture and its heavy reliance on water. Agriculture uses 80% of California's water, but was largely left out of Governor Jerry Brown's first-ever limits on water use. So should agriculture be subject to limits, and what are alternative models? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Nock Nguyen produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, and Matt Martin is executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.